We're often attracted to difference. Eros energy is drawn to mystery and difference. Mm-hmm. And so we often seek someone who does the world differently than we do. When you're up against those differences, it can be really frustrating. It's like, not only you're not making me happy, you're making me unhappy. And maybe I married the wrong person. It hurts and it's disillusioning. And some people just grow into resentment and they get into power struggles and they don't understand that nothing is going wrong and that these differences are an opportunity to grow into someone that can know and accept another. Mm-hmm. And that is the work of marriage.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Hey everyone, it's Christy, Dr. Finlayson Fife's assistant, and I have commandeered the microphone to let you know that you have just a few days left to pick up copies of her new book, That We Might Have Joy, from Amazon and still get them delivered in time for Christmas. If you're listening to this podcast, my guess is you have already read the book cover to cover multiple times yourself. But what I love most about the book, besides those searingly insightful questions at the end of most chapters, is that it's the perfect way to introduce your friends and family to Dr. Finlayson Fife's work. For less than $20, you can gift this masterpiece of a book that she has poured her heart and soul into for the past 5 years and introduce people to the concepts and theories that you and I both know will change their lives. So click the link in the show notes and do it quickly because there are only a few days left to order and get it in time for Christmas. Thanks everyone, Merry Christmas.
Welcome back to the Stone and Clay Podcast. This is episode 142. Today we have an awesome guest. This is Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife, which just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? JFF.
That's right.
Well, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Jennifer is, you know, an appellation you tend to have is the Mormon sex therapist, right? Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure was that sort of thrust upon you, no pun intended?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Just kind of, there wasn't a lot going on in that space. And right. I wrote my dissertation in 2002, but kind of before the internet. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as my kids were getting a little more established and the internet was actually happening, I was invited onto a podcast and to be interviewed about my dissertation research on Latter-day Saint women and their relationship to sexuality and their sense of self. And so that just kind of went viral in a to my, you know, specific group. And was really touching a need. And so that really was kind of the launch of the work I do.
Okay, very cool. So specifically your dissertation was about what exactly?
I was actually asked to teach human sexuality to undergrads at Boston College, which is a largely Catholic Jesuit school. And so a lot of the men and women were writing essays about their personal experiences. And I could see a lot of kind of challenge, especially within the women in their relationship to sexuality, a lot of shame and anxiety. I was trying to come up with a dissertation topic, and I was really thinking about what are Mormon women's experience? Like, do they feel a sense of peace and ease around sexuality? How are they transitioning into marriage? And so that just became the focus, was to look at women who had grown up within a conservative LDS religion, were still active in the religion and were now married. And what was their experience of their body, of sexuality? How was that transition into marriage and a sexual relationship? And I was just looking at what were the factors for women who transitioned poorly into an intimate relationship and what were the factors for women who transitioned well? Yeah.
And gotcha. So what's the conclusion?
What was the takeaway?
Yeah.
Well, you know, basically it was very interesting because most of the women fit my hypothesis, which is in a kind of male-led institution, the focus is going to basically be focused on men's sexuality more than women's sexuality.
And their desires and needs.
Exactly. Yeah. And so women are kind of, their sexuality, they understand it in reference to men's needs. Mm-hmm. And so that was my question, was this, because there's some feminist literature out there that suggests this is what happens, you know, if you look at very starkly patriarchal societies, you can see that women's sexuality is considered a threat or secondary. And so I was curious, is this what Mormon women's experiences are? And for most of the women, it was that. They really thought about sex as something you do for a future spouse, that keeping yourself pure is primary, that it's a way of earning your value, and then it's just something you do to serve his needs. And so they were quite disconnected from it, did not like sex, felt like it was something they should do or even should like, but just didn't.
An obligation.
An obligation. Yeah. And of course, their husbands felt it the same way, which is that there's no passion, there's no energy. And, and so, but a minority of the women just didn't bring any of the sexism to the theology. They saw themselves as equal to men. They saw their desires around sex, but just in their lives in general, as equal to their husbands. Like they just, they took themselves seriously. Yeah. They had a strong sense of agency. And even though they, the women I interviewed anyway, had actually related to the teachings in the church around, you know, waiting until marriage and so on, they took those things seriously, but they didn't do it out of a sense of self-rejection or that sexuality is a bad thing. In fact, they saw sex as a really great thing and something they were looking forward to, but they were, this was a way of keeping it special. So it was a very different relationship to a conservative choice. So the group that did poorly saw it as more from a fear-based frame, more from a place of shame. The women who did well saw it as a positive thing and something that they actually wanted to preserve for the right context, the right relationship. And so they transitioned quite easily. So even though they had engaged their sexuality very little premaritally, it wasn't the challenging transition that it was for some of the other women.
Right. So is one of the major challenges in not just in Mormon culture, but any group that is leans a little bit more conservative or abstemious, is the challenge you're like sex is sort of this forbidden taboo thing. And then all of a sudden you have free reign. And you, so you go from zero to 100 pretty fast. Is that part of the challenge?
Yeah. I mean, one of the concepts I talk about a lot is sexual integration, is that is our goal. And that is it to kind of, to be able to understand sexuality as part of the human experience, as actually a good part of the human experience, and learning how to relate to it in a way that accrues to our well-being. And all humans are up against those questions. How do we relate to pleasure in a way that actually enriches our lives and makes them better? Because we can, of course, relate to pleasure in a way that destroys our lives. But then there's the opposite reaction where some people are afraid of pleasure and they see it as the pathway to you know, to bad things. And so they reject all pleasure, which also interferes with our lives. And so it's how do I integrate this? How do I relate to this in a way that's in line with my beliefs and my integrity and but creates joy and goodness in my life? And so that's the challenge. But now I already forgot your question, Taylor. Sorry.
You're good. Just is the challenge going from, you know, zero to 100? Because like, even for myself, like I have somehow by the grace of the Lord, like managed to not be sexually active later in life, later than I'd hoped. And I know that when I do get married, all of a sudden it'll be like, it's red light, green light.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is a bit, it's a bit disconcerting. Right? It's a lot to deal with.
It can be. So I think that when people relate to sexuality and pleasure from a frame primarily of fear, then it makes the transition very awkward and challenging.
Right.
Because even now, though now it's legal, there's this sense that this is actually kind of forbidden or dangerous, or this is going to, this could undermine me, undermine our marriage. And so, but the people that actually are able to integrate it, they don't see it as inherently dangerous. They see it as a powerful thing. So relating to it wisely matters. But if you relate to it wisely, it can be a very, very good thing in your life. And so they're not relating to it from a place of fear, but more desire. What is the life I want to create? What kind of sexual relationship or marriage do I want to have? Is this choice going to facilitate that possibility or interfere with it? And it's amazing when you put something in the frame of desire, it gives a lot more possibility and agency to it. Mm-hmm. When we teach from a frame of fear, we really teach the idea that sexuality is more powerful than you are. Yeah. And if you really believe that, then it's like, okay, well, now it's technically legal, but what if this gets out of control? What if this mm-hmm. undermines me? What if this hurts my partner? You know, it's hard to know how to relate to this language of sexuality if you've always had a sense of fear that is infecting that understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. How is sex related to self-esteem? Because it feels like they can't help but be connected.
They are, I think.
Right? Because when you're talking about intimacy, there's so much validation on the table.
Yes.
And so I feel like so many partners perhaps have struggles in their sex life because one or both partners struggle with their own self-worth and their own self-esteem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to really let someone in on who you are is a real act of courage. Mm-hmm. And it's really letting somebody know you. And having a basic sense of self-respect is really essential to daring to let someone in on who you are. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece of it. The other thing is, do I deserve pleasure? Yeah, do I deserve love? Do I deserve to be cared for and known at this level? Mm-hmm. And those are all questions that are really present when you let someone in. And if you're not sure, then you're going to be really looking to them to validate you and to make it okay. And if your partner has enough anxiety, they may not be in a position to validate your sexuality. They may have their own anxieties about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think if our sense of self is compromised or challenged or uncertain, we will do one of two things, which is either I'm not deserving of any pleasure, or I'm sort of needy around it and I need you to make it okay. And I need, you know, you to give me something through my sexuality that will solve a question inside of me. And neither one of those really works in a long-term relationship.
Right.
If you can hold your sense of self enough to dare to let someone in, enough to dare to let yourself experience pleasure and to be known in that way, I mean, then you can really access a kind of beauty and solace and joy mm-hmm. in a marriage. But I think it requires believing in a God that wants us to be joyful,
right.
Believing in a God that understands pleasure to be a balm in our lives. Not pleasure for its own sake or pleasure at the expense of mm-hmm. somebody else, but a pleasure that actually expands us and grounds us.
Yeah, I've never thought about it like that, that asking ourselves that question, do I deserve pleasure?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Because I think a lot of us ask, like, do I deserve love? You know, do I deserve to be happy? But do I deserve pleasure is a really nuanced question.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And is it okay to enjoy my life? Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a client once who the family ethos was that to have pleasure or acknowledge pleasure was morally less. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like even to be proud of yourself for something was somehow like a lesser position.
Yeah.
And not surprisingly, she struggled a lot around sex and intimacy because there just was no room in the way she'd grown up mm-hmm. learning that you could just enjoy life,
right.
That you could take pleasure in being alive. And so much of what intimate love is taking pleasure in the other person's presence.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, and that's what we want. We want our partner to take pleasure in being with us. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of a narcissism in it, like that I give you pleasure just by being here. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm serving your needs, right.
But if it's reciprocated, it's not narcissism.
No. Yeah. It's not a narcissism that interferes. Mm-hmm. It's a positive narcissism. I don't know how to say it. Like, I turn you on. I give you pleasure by being here. That adds to our own pleasure. And, you know, it seems selfish or strange, but it's like, it's something that really, you know, if you think about a baby, a parent that is kissing and enjoying that baby, the mother, let's say, is taking pleasure in their existence. Mm-hmm. So she's kissing and holding and she's just enjoying them because they exist.
Yeah, yeah.
And that adds to the baby's sense of self. Mm-hmm. They know that on some level the parent is in love with them. That's the lucky baby. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to do anything or prove anything. Their existence is enough to delight another soul.
Yeah.
I think we're looking for that energy in sex. Mm-hmm. That's what we want. It's what we have when we fall in love. We see like, oh, this person that attracts me and lights me up, I light them up. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the binding energy of falling in love. And it's what we want in a marriage. It's what we want in a long-term connection, is that feeling with the other person.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I was so excited to have this conversation because I feel like me and my friends are so open, and, you know, most of my friends are married. And so we're often asking each other, like, not the gritty details, but yeah, about each other's sex lives, yeah, and are they happy? Are they satisfied?
Yeah.
What's working? And I just know so many people that are deeply unsatisfied with their sex lives.
100%.
And it really makes me sad because I'm like, I don't feel like it needs to be this way, but I guess it's just such a complicated human thing
it's
really hard to have a healthy, happy sexual life that is sustainable for a long period of time.
It is.
Yeah.
It takes skills. It takes development that we often don't know we lack until we're in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is really the book that I've just finished is really about, is how to utilize a marriage to grow into a person more capable of intimate love.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you fall in love, you just get the gift of experiencing it. And dopamine helps, and the novelty of falling in love certainly helps, but you're just in that rich, amazing experience of just feeling that another person is just glad you exist,
yeah,
and you feel the same way about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the inspiration of the marriage. It's what makes you think we can do this. It's very important. It's an mm-hmm. important phase. But then when you move in together and you start to work out a life together, you start realizing like they weren't designed to make me happy. They're actually seem perfectly designed to make me unhappy.
right.
Because we're often attracted to difference. I mean,
sure,
the erotic love or Eros energy is drawn to mystery and difference. Mm-hmm. And so we often seek someone who does the world differently than we do.
Yeah.
And so when you're up against those differences, it can be really frustrating. It's like, not only you're not making me happy, you're making me unhappy. And maybe I married the wrong person. And so you're now up against the not getting what you want.
Mm-hmm.
It's what Terry Real, the therapist, says. It's, you know, you have the love without knowledge phase when you fall in love, but then it goes to the knowledge without love phase.
Yeah.
And it hurts and it's disillusioning. And some people just grow into resentment and they get into sort of power struggles and they don't understand that nothing is going wrong and that these differences are an opportunity to grow into someone that can know and accept another. Mm. And that is the work of marriage. It
right.
is the task of marriage. And it's very rewarding work. I mean, I don't mean to say it like it's the work, you know, it's so hard
because
but if you can understand, like, look, marriage never was supposed to be that I lock someone in who has to love me no matter how immature I am.
Yeah.
That I actually promised when I married that I was going to bring my best to this person, mm-hmm. that I was going to love them despite challenges. And so how do I grow into someone who can really make room for a person who's quite different than me?
Yeah.
And if we can not be resentful, but grow into someone who can know and understand another as well as be known and understood, you actually have in the marriage itself the structure of passion. You mm. have difference, you have polarity. And if you have resentment with that, it doesn't work.
Right.
But if you can actually accept that person that's different than you,
mm-hmm.
right, then you have the energy that creates passion, that creates desire, even in someone that you know very well. And human beings, I always teach, we want two things that feel like they are in contradiction. But if we grow, we find that we can have both of these things. And that is that we want to belong to another person. We want to feel accepted by them. We want to know that we're safe with them. But we also want to belong to our individuality.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to betray ourselves or not fulfill our own ambitions and desires and be true to who we are.
Yeah.
And when we're falling in love, it feels like, oh, I get to have both because they're just going to back me up no matter what.
Yeah.
When you are in that stage of disillusionment, it feels like I get one or the other. I'm either at peace with you or I'm at peace with myself, but I don't know how to have both.
Mm-hmm.
But as we grow, then we become more capable of actually accepting a person in all their difference and
right.
making room for them to thrive. while not betraying ourselves, mm-hmm. we learn how to creatively sort out a way to be partners, to really have a marriage while not asking the other one to be less. And that's really what is required to have long-term passionate or intimate yeah. sex.
Okay, yeah. So when you meet with couples, would you say there's maybe two or three main reasons why their sex life is suffering? Are there, can you see just kind of obvious patterns?
It's a good question. I have to think about that. Let me just think out loud. I mean, sometimes there is intrapersonal challenges. So that is like somebody has a lot of anxiety about sex itself. Mm-hmm. Maybe they had some sexual trauma. Maybe mm-hmm. they grew up learning that sex was a lesser part of being human. And so there's not conflict in the marriage per se, but they are really struggling to even make room for their sexuality.
Yeah.
And you know, when sex is at its best, it's very soulful. You're bringing, mm-hmm. you feel like I can be myself with you.
Yeah.
And yet if you don't feel like it's okay for sexuality to belong to your sense of self, mm-hmm. there's just work to do there to make peace with your embodied sexual nature, to be able to forge a partnership, right? So there's that piece that's often there. And men do it as well. Mm-hmm. Even men that can be compulsive or, you know, they're looking at porn a lot or whatever, it looks like they're more comfortable with sex than mm-hmm. maybe their more repressed partner.
Yeah.
But that's also a lack of sexual integration. That's also, yeah. they're not actually at peace in their sexuality. They're vacillating between some obsessiveness and some repression. Mm-hmm. And so they also aren't integrated.
Yeah.
So there's that category. And then I would say there's the category of just the struggle in the question of how do I belong to me and you? And the resentment that can come in that struggle, or like sometimes people suppress themselves. Men have a way of doing this. Women have a way of doing it, which is suppressing themselves in order to keep the peace.
Yeah.
But their resentment follows right behind.
Right. And it's not real peace.
It's not real peace. And yeah. if you can't be yourself in the marriage, how are you going to be yourself in sex?
Right.
And
right.
and for sex to be good, you have to feel like you can be yourself. Yeah. You have to feel like I can be with you. I can show you who I am. And there's a real peace here. Mm-hmm. And so many of the couples I work with, I mean, they're lying next to somebody at night that they feel a lot of turmoil with. And even if they have sex, you know, twice a week, it's not necessarily the kind of sex that's really, you know, bonding them.
Yeah, it's
you
not
know?
Really soulful.
It's not like soulful. You said. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, wow. So I feel like from, obviously I'm a man, so I tend to hear the side of the men,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
But I feel like so often I hear the big problem being, and obviously this is a really reductive take, but that men want it 5, 6, sure. 7 times a week,
sure.
and the wife wants it once or twice.
Yeah.
And so there's immediate
yeah.
disconnect.
No. Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the problem with men and women getting married.
Right.
And it's kind of, it's true. I mean, I would say because of testosterone, mm-hmm. Men feel desire much more spontaneously. It's just, there's less on the line, biologically speaking, for men to be sexual.
Right.
And so I think men are wired up more to just desire, to notice a woman, to want to be sexual, to notice their wife's beauty. Mm-hmm. And it's like, why wouldn't I want to do that with you, right? You're so attractive and so on.
And we tend, I might be wrong, but I feel like we tend to be less critical about our own bodies.
Yes, absolutely. I think men are more comfortable in the language of the body. They don't have that self-reflexive perfectionism that I think women often have. Mm-hmm. And women have it because of the culture, but women have it in part too, because really good sex is feminine centric. It's about the beauty of the female.
Yeah.
It's the woman's pleasure that's often the focus
yeah.
of really good sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so first of all, if women don't think they're supposed to have pleasure, it certainly challenges this dynamic. If women don't feel that they're beautiful, and when we have a really narrow view, that can really interfere. But if women can't sort of accept their worthiness and accept their inherent beauty, it can interfere. But women also care a lot about the quality of sex. So if I were to say, just sort of in gross terms, men are fixated on quantity and women on quality.
Right.
Both matter. Mm-hmm. They do. And men have a gift of testosterone sure. and pursuit, honestly. They really do.
Yeah.
But women are also often care about, like, do you love me? Do you choose me? Is it about me or is it about sex? Right?
Right.
So all the films that are romantic films for women are very focused on this, the narrative of the man who sees her and values her as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, he also is drawn to her beauty. That's a part of his desire for her, but it's more than that. It's not just about how it serves his needs.
Right.
It's that he's actually invested in her. And this is a big question that women just naturally carry biologically.
Mm-hmm.
Is this about sex with me or just having sex?
Right, mm-hmm. right. Yeah, you know, something I've struggled with is I feel like so many women, because for a long time, or a large period of their life, it's been about their beauty, about how they yes. look, about their yeah. sexuality.
Yeah.
And because of that, they almost rebuff a compliment about their appearance.
Yeah.
Right? And so it puts the male in an awkward position where I want to compliment you on your beauty and whatever,
yeah.
but then sometimes it's taken as, oh, you just like me because I'm hot, or
yeah.
you just like me for my body. And it's like, okay, how much do I compliment? How much do I mention, you know?
Mention it a lot.
Yeah.
It's all fake when it's like, men are pigs. What did he say exactly?
Well, and obviously this is in, you know, this is more in courtship.
Yeah.
Right. So it's different when you're living together and you're married.
Yeah,
and,
sure, sure. I mean, I'm kind of teasing a little bit. So I think in some ways women are, when I say men are pigs, you know, like there was a, you know, a funny sitcom that was playing off that idea, which is like men are pigs. But what was he saying about me exactly? That is, yeah. we like to feel attractive. It's part of most women. The turn on is to be the turn on
mm-hmm.
and to feel like I'm compelling for him.
Yeah.
Now, not if it's only about the physicality.
Right.
Women want to know that it's more than that, but they certainly want their beauty to be acknowledged,
yeah.
most women. Okay?
You know what I do? My approach
yeah.
in courtship,
yeah.
I don't bring up their beauty at all until we like, it's established that we kind of like each other
yeah.
and we're hanging out and stuff.
I think that's
and
smart.
And then I pour it on.
Yeah, that's smart,
but,
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, exactly. And that I really am into you and they can feel that you're into them.
Mm-hmm.
And then their beauty is actually an expression of not just their physical beauty, but liking them and knowing them and being drawn to them. And I think in some ways, if men know that they are invested in the woman, there's no need to apologize for finding her beautiful. It's
right.
men's gift in a way is to be drawn to and to recognize feminine beauty.
We got good eyes.
Yeah, you guys yeah. do. And you know, like when I ask men, like men see their wives often, the men I work with much kinder assessment than women sometimes do for themselves. Now, this is because certainly we have a beauty industry that exploits that anxiety, but the self-reflexive part, you know, it's very easy to, you know, to be hypercritical, to, you know, to doubt your beauty and to not actually see yourself properly. It's just, it's an easy thing to do. And, but if you have a male witness who's speaking honestly to you, you know, that's very helpful. It's like, well, I'm not going to lie to you. You are beautiful. Like I see you that way.
Yeah.
And to see the soul beauty of the other person. So I think if you recognize and value the whole person, there's nothing to apologize for in recognizing their beauty. And,
yeah.
and especially when it's about who they are as much as how they look.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, this is a really hard question. Luckily, I don't have like a wife at home that is.
Yeah.
will be listening to this. But what do you tell couples that are struggling with feeling like their attraction for the other is waning a little bit?
Yeah.
Because A, that's an almost impossible thing to bring up to your spouse.
Yeah.
And B, it's almost like, is that even an appropriate emotion?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great.
I mean, I think it is.
Yeah.
I think that...
To me, it's just like whether it's deeply hurtful or not, it's what I feel.
Yeah.
Or what somebody feels.
I think it's important. And one of the goals of the book that I wrote is just helping us actually appreciate the value of erotic love.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to be like, well, it needs to be agape. Like it's this kind of love that has no conditions. And I think any good marriage has that quality mm-hmm. that I'm really here for you. I'm really your friend. But it understands Eros as equal in importance in a marriage, yeah. in a marriage, because it's a relationship based on desire and choice. That's how it starts. And so it's that foundational meaning of I desire you and you desire me. And that we're choosing to bring our sexuality no other place but mm-hmm. to each other. And so to hold that as important. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, oh, to manage my husband's needs. It's yeah. more that it's good for us. It's yeah. good for the soul of the marriage. You know, it's the sacrament of the marriage, mm-hmm. the sexual relationship. And so honoring it is important. But I think when people lose attraction, if it's about just really superficial things, you can't tolerate that your wife is going to age because she's a human being. Okay, right. Well, then you've got some issues.
Sure.
If you can't just accept her as a whole real person, mm-hmm. then you've got something going on that your challenge with attraction is more about your narrowness and your limitation. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if your challenge with attraction is because your spouse, and this could go both directions, isn't really living. Do you know they're more in retrenchment? They're more like phoning it in life. They're not treating their body well. Yeah. They're not living and doing things in the world. Then attractiveness is going to be low because they're not actually at peace in themselves.
They're not as vibrant.
They're not as vibrant. Yeah. They're not actually engaged in living well. My mom, after my dad passed away, she was 88 or 89, and she had always wanted to dance. She'd grown up on a farm in Idaho. It had always been something she wanted to do, but never had done. She got married early, you know, well, not that early, but for an LDS person, it was later, but she was still had 8 children. And so when my dad passed away, she just walked into a dance studio and signed up for 2 dance lessons. She was 89. Okay.
I love that.
Okay. Well, she loved it. And my mom, pictures of her at 90 and 91, she was radiating life. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just was, because she was living.
Right.
And so here she was 90 and yet truly beautiful because she was leaning into life.
Yeah.
And she was not, you know, just waiting for it to end. Mm-hmm. And so that's attractive.
Right.
You know, my husband was saying to me once when we first got married, because I was worrying about, was I going to put on weight because I wasn't running any longer, something I had been doing when I was single. And he's like, Jennifer, you can put on a lot of weight and I will still be attracted to you. But what would be unattractive is if you hated yourself.
Right.
If you aren't thriving, if mm-hmm. you aren't radiating, because I think the masculine is drawn to that life energy of the yeah, feminine, and yeah. the feminine is a life energy. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what it's about often. Mm. You know, some men don't know how to love a whole person. Okay.
Right.
And that's one thing.
Right.
But if you're not really living your life well, then that's hard to be drawn to.
Yeah. So how do you have that conversation with the spouse?
Well, I think, like
it's, hey, you're not alive right now.
Yeah, it's not good for the husband in that situation. It's not good for the wife either. If somebody is just moved into a place of kind of giving up and mm-hmm. depression, and to say, like, I miss the thriving you.
Yeah.
I don't feel it. And it's hard. And I'm sure it's hard on you too. And I long for that part of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so it's not saying, like, I wish you were someone else. It's like, I wish you were more you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really beautiful way of putting it. There's a song lyric from, do you know who John Bellion is?
I don't know.
Well, you should.
Oh, yeah.
But he has this lyric where he says in the chorus, he says, what happened to your light?
Exactly.
And it's such an interesting.
That's it right there.
Yeah.
We're drawn to the light in the other person. I mean, yeah. that's the soul beauty.
Yeah.
And to commune with that light is what sustains our souls.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what erotic love is we're leaning into. Like Eros love is the desire to commune.
Yeah.
And it's to commune with divinity. It's to commune with another soul. It's to commune with the world. And that's what lights us up. It's what it's expands our souls.
Mm-hmm.
That's the antidepressant of life.
Right.
And yet life is hard, and there's loss, and there's fear, and there's uncertainty. And so while we have this Eros draw, we also have the Thanatos pull into safety and predictability and wanting the world to yield to us more than to yield to the world. And mm-hmm. so understandably, we can do these things where we pull into fear, we pull into, not wanting the marriage to grow or change, but we pay a big price when we won't grow.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I can never say this theologian's name, but anyway, he said something like, sin is the refusal to grow.
That's a really good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we think of sin as making mistakes. I think sin is not learning from mistakes, not being willing to grow from them.
Right. Because we all make mistakes nonstop.
Of course. How else is there? I mean, yeah. Right. No. Yeah. It's a fantasy that we don't.
How do you bridge the gap between, I feel like Christians, conservative people can often really struggle with eroticism versus spirituality.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And having... saying, I want to be a really spiritual person. I want to be really connected with God. And eroticism feels sinful. It feels taboo. It feels wild, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But within the confines of a marriage and a loving partnership, that should exist, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think one of the things that we get right in conservative faith is that we want to be careful with our sexuality, uh-huh. right? So it's okay to have expectations and structure and learning how to have breaks around pleasure, right? Yeah. You know, you think about a child, they get their hand down their pants and they're, you know, running around naked. And that's all great when they're two, but,
right.
but at a certain point, it's time to cover up and it's time to learn how to be in polite society and
right.
learning how to inhibit.
Yeah, and when you're 10, it's not cute anymore.
Exactly. It's no longer cute, right? Yeah. And so that is an important process. Now, if we shame a lot to mm-hmm. inhibit, then it interferes with the larger goal of integration, right?
Right.
But if you can just teach to basically inhibit and manage, then you actually can, you know, to create what you want, you need to have breaks.
Yeah.
And so if you can learn to self-regulate around pleasure, then you can go and forge something beautiful. So if we can use the limits to forge capacity, mm-hmm. marriage is even a way of choosing a limit that forges soul capacity.
Yeah.
If we relate to limits like prison or shame, okay, then it interferes with that larger goal. And so yes, there is something, you know, indulgence is antithetical mm-hmm. to spirituality.
Right.
Because if you indulge your way through life, you're going to be in a psychological hell soon enough.
Yeah. It's just gluttony.
It's gluttony.
Yeah.
And it divides you from yourself. It divides you from others. And so there is no peace. Mm-hmm. And so there's something there when people are saying it feels like two different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can learn to accept myself as a sexual being, if I can learn to accept myself and make choices that accrue to my well-being,
mm-hmm.
that make me more capable of loving with sexuality, and to be able to create that with another person, to create a real relationship, imperfect, flawed, sometimes frustrating, but real, right, then we actually start to feel the spirituality of sex.
Mm-hmm.
And not that we're having deep spiritual experiences necessarily, but even just these moments of honest communion, of honest peace, of honest connection that are very powerful and sustaining for us. And, you know, Dr. Stephen Schneider, he says this is the sanctification of the ordinary in mm-hmm. sex. These just these moments of meeting, of when the world time sort of stops, stands still, and you have each other. And it's a way that the soul can kind of be nourished
yeah.
through these moments of connection that we need that sustain us in the day-to-day of life.
Right, right.
Yeah.
What do you wish, you've been married, how long have you been married now?
Oh gosh, 27 years, okay. 28 years.
What do you know now that you wish like those first couple of years you would have kind of understood better about sex?
Mm. Well, I had a big advantage on that. So in the sense that I had been studying it already before I got married.
Okay, yeah.
I was almost 30.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why, but I, as a younger person, and that's how I'm doing the work that I'm doing, I would go to the lessons at church mm-hmm. that were kind of shaming and fear-driven around sex. And I would be like, wow, that person's got issues with sex. Like,
right, right.
Like, I mean, I'm not saying that those lessons didn't affect me at all.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
they did. I think I had some real anxiety about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had another voice that was kind of saying, this can be a good thing in life.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I did wait until we were married,
yeah.
but we did it also from that kind of conscious, chosen way, not mm-hmm. out of shame or
yeah,
that
yeah.
there was something wrong about the desire that we had for
yeah.
each other.
You just wanted it to be special.
Yeah, we yeah. really did. We valued that idea very mm-hmm. much. And so it made the transition pretty easy, mm-hmm. actually. And And so I'm grateful for that. I think if just in the concrete terms, I think I would have just told myself, don't expect anything phenomenal on the wedding night.
Sure, sure.
I mean, like it might be a little bit of a process figuring this out, and that's okay. Right. And just enjoy figuring it out. And it's, you know, that would have helped. I think what would have helped in the kind of larger picture is to not see conflict and struggle in the beginning as anything going wrong.
Right.
Is that you're actually trying to forge how to live together, how to create a marriage out of these differences.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that there's some people there that are just doing it without any challenges is mostly fantasy. It's
right.
just not real. And so embrace the process for what it is. And I mean, maybe just hold on to what you actually desire. Why are you doing it in the first place? It's because
right.
I want to love this person. I want to be this person. I want to work out a life with him. Because I think some of my perfectionism would kick in, like we're not doing it the right way or there's something wrong with us.
Yeah.
So I think it would have been helpful to know that. But I was almost 30 and he's older than I am. So we just had a little more maturity.
Yes, yeah.
It helped a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel like in those early stages when a couple is new to it together, do you think it's helpful to almost have these like post-coital meetings, like where you're kind of saying like, what was good? What was bad? How could we improve? What did you like?
Yeah.
What did I like?
I mean, certainly if you're not able to talk, if you feel afraid of talking about it, what I would say, you know, it's not so much that people must communicate about it. The problem is if they won't communicate.
Right.
If there's things to be said and they won't say them, or they're afraid if they say them, it will make their spouse feel like they've failed.
Right.
The thing that's so hard about sex is that it's so close to our souls.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really afraid, how to say it? It really punctures us if our spouse isn't happy with exactly what we're doing. And so it takes some temerity and some, you know, just the willingness to hear and understand the other and know what their experience is and just to keep at it, you know?
Yeah.
Keep coming back to it over and over.
Right, yeah.
Hey everyone, it's Christy again, and through Saturday, you can save $200 on any of Dr. Finlayson Fife's stateside workshops and retreats. We have never offered $200 off of an in-person event before, and we're offering it on all of them. So that includes the Strengthening Your Relationship workshop in Southern California in January, the Sex Worth Wanting retreat in Hillsboro, Oregon in June. That event sold out last year quickly, so be sure to grab your ticket quick for that while it's on sale. The Art of Desire retreat in Hillsboro, Oregon in August, or the Art of Loving retreat in Southern Utah in November. Click the link in the show notes to see our upcoming event schedule and purchase your ticket by Saturday and you'll save $200. And thanks to some very generous contributions from past event attendees, we have some limited scholarship funding for these events. So if finances are standing in the way, email office@finlayson-fife.com and ask for the scholarship application. We would love to have you join us. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
Do you feel like there's a certain average age where couples, whatever amount of sex they're having, it just starts to decline significantly?
That's conventional thinking, certainly that it is. I mean,
I just mean in average.
Yes and no. So I would say, yeah. I mean, it depends on the couple.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it's like when they first get married, it's like every day because they're both way into it and they both really like it. And then, you know, the next year it drops a little and then the next year it drops a little more.
Yeah.
But I do think in a marriage that's sort of alive and there's an enjoyable sexual relationship, it's just a regular part of the marriage. It's just a part of the sustaining quality and that they miss each other if they don't have that connection. You know, there was some research that showed that people that were having sex, you know, 5+ times a week were not as happy as people having it 2 to 3 times a week. So that is that. Or it might have even been like 1 to 2 times a week is what it was. And it might be because the people having it 5 times a week, it's under duress. Like one person is trying to produce something for a more demanding partner.
Yeah.
You know, if both people are like wanting that, that's only going to be good for the marriage, right? But I think that it's more the quality of what's happening and if it feels honest and real. I mean, I remember hearing an older woman say this, and I can't remember who it was. Actually, but she said something like, my husband and I made love every night of our marriage. Sometimes we had sex. Okay. And what she's talking about, and to me, I was like, yes, I know what she's talking about. Mm-hmm. It's this kind of coming together, feeling sexual energy with one another, feeling that sort of delight in each other. Not cuddling. I mean, like, energy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're like pushing up against each other. You like each other. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that leads to sex. Sometimes that leads to drifting off to sleep. And that energy is just a part of the marriage. It's part of the relationship.
Yeah.
And that's when that's lacking, that's when people are really unhappy in marriage. And it has more to do with that energy than quantity per se.
Right. Okay. So, and maybe this is so personal and case by case, but let's say, as a woman, your desire to be intimate with your husband on a particular night is pretty low, okay? But he is really pursuing it, and you're kind of like, I could do it. It's not that big of a deal. It'll make him happy, whatever. Should you go through with it?
I would encourage someone to not do it in that way.
Yeah.
Either choose it or don't choose it.
Right.
But not in the, okay, it'll make him happy. I'll suffer through. Yeah. I mean, I think that cultivates resentment because he feels it.
Yeah.
Unless he's totally checked out. Right. He feels that she's not excited and she's just accommodating me. And then he can feel resentment too, right? So I think that it often creates the wrong meaning rather than I have a choice to make. Either I'm like really here for it and I'm going to like, you know, okay, like, and I don't mean to say that you can't say like, I feel really tired, but let's see if I can get in the mood.
Rally.
Like I'll try. Like, yeah. But you know, you're in it, you're trying, you know, you want to get there. Or to say, I really can't tonight, but let's try, you know, tomorrow or whatever. Instead of the resentful accommodation, I think that's more dangerous.
It might be kind of like if your partner wants to go to the ballet and you're like, I do not want to go, but I'll go if it makes you happy and I'll have a good attitude and I'll put on a good face.
I think it's fine I wouldn't even say I'll put on a good face. I would say, no, you either say, okay, I'm really going to go because I choose this person.
Yeah.
It's not that I love ballet or that I want to go to the ballet tonight, but I'm either really going to go.
Yeah.
And, or I'm not going to go.
Right.
And what I mean by be careful of good face and is it sometimes.
I'm
going to
be present and I'm going to be like.
I'm just kind of particular about language because it really does have impact.
Oh,
so sometimes if we're like, I want my spouse to feel loved, therefore I'm going to go suffer through the ballet. I still think that's not quite it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like either really do it because you love them and you choose it and you're there for it or you don't.
Yeah.
But not like I need to do it and then she better give me sex after the ballet.
Right, right, right. Well, you know, one of my best friends from high school, we've been friends forever. He was engaged to this girl and he comes home one day and I was like, dude, what were you doing all day? And he's like, oh dude, we went horseback riding. She loves horses. And he's like, so I guess I do too now.
Yeah.
And he was like, so earnestly like, I like horses now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he just loved her so much. He's like, this is important to her.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't do it otherwise.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to now.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love that.
Well, the people that are the happiest in marriage, the research suggests, is people that feel like by being married, they grew into someone they like even more. So that is, it wasn't just that they like their spouse, that they like themselves more through who they became in the marriage, that they experienced more, that their sense of self broadened.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can really experience the world more through the other person, through that difference.
Yeah.
If you just resent it and you're like, just be like me so we can be happy, you're going to struggle a lot more than, you know, I love this person and learning about them and sharing things with them expands me too.
Yeah. No one really wants to be married to themselves.
No.
Yeah.
Be the worst. I feel sorry for my husband.
Yeah. I'm currently married to myself. Yeah. It's not great. I want to touch on this. I read the introduction to your book that's coming out and I love this phrase here. So it says, the gift of human intimacy deepens not only our connection to a spouse and divinity, it expands our capacity for joy.
Mm.
And I've always talked about with friends and people I care about that I feel like I have a large capacity for joy.
Mm.
And I feel like it almost makes it harder to find a partner because I'm not okay with small amounts of joy. I want something rich and vibrant and big and, you know, but talk to me about how having a good, deep connection with your intimacy and with divinity can expand your joy.
Well, so let me speak to just that first piece, which is, I think in some ways, the chances of you having a really good partnership are often connected, perhaps paradoxically, to your willingness to not have one. That is to say, if you can understand that your life could be rich and meaningful even without one, it means your ability to choose has actually gone up because you really can envision an alternative.
Yeah.
Those of us that feel like, oh, I have to get married or else I won't be a legitimate person or I won't be able to know happiness. I'm not dissing marriage by any stretch, but
it's born out of desperation.
If it's out of anxiety and desperation, it's less about a choice and really choosing another soul. Mm-hmm. And so, so being able to really choose your partner, I think really adds to the foundation of a marriage that can be joyful. But I think that there's nothing more beautiful and remarkable than feeling like there's somebody who fully knows you, that you can be your whole self with, and that they like you, that they like being there with you, that they can know you in every way, and that you're really forging a home. It's interesting, like psychologically, it feels like a home.
Yeah.
I remember once being in church and the person teaching the lesson said, think of a sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
And what came into my head right away was my bed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels so like the, it's just a place of deep peace, connection, friendship, the one place where I can be fully myself.
Mm.
And I just think that's joyful. It's like, you know, it's even, you know, a lot of people I work with will even have moments of it moving them to tears to feel that received, that loved, to feel that they can experience joy with another beloved partner.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in the relationships I've had that have moved me the most, it's when you start to feel like, I didn't know this level of joy existed, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's even like without any sexual intimacy, you know, but it's just finding that deep connection
and
emotional intimacy.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.